I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a white northerner moves south and considers the legacy of a Confederate general and slave trader still treated like a noble hero. We'll spend this hour with journalist Connor Towne O'Neill, who was stunned to find so many monuments dedicated to Nathan Bedford Forrest, the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who even after the Civil War found ways to profit off the unpaid labor of Black Americans. We'll talk with O'Neill about what he learned about the origins of the lost cause mythology of the Old South and the function of that thinking even today, and about how O'Neill came to realize he benefited from white supremacy even though he held anti-racist views. Our conversation starts after a short break. There's no other way to put this. Nathan Bedford Forrest was a very bad guy. He made his living in human trafficking before the Civil War, buying and selling enslaved people. As a general in the Confederate Army, he commanded a massacre of hundreds of Black Union troops after those soldiers had surrendered. And after the war, Forrest returned to his trade in human flesh, this time selling convict labor. The state of Tennessee was home to three U.S. presidents, but to this day, there are more monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest than to Andrew Jackson, Andrew Johnson, and James Polk combined. Seriously? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Connor Towne O'Neill is a producer of the NPR podcast White Lies. He is originally from Pennsylvania, moved south to attend a writing program at the University of Alabama, and now teaches at Auburn University and the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. He started looking into the profusion of public tributes to Nathan Bedford Forrest in 2015, and in addition to learning a great deal about the white compulsion to recontextualize the Civil War as being about something other than perpetuating slavery, the past 5 years have forced him to confront the way white people all over America have continued to benefit from white supremacy despite a desire to believe we are not part of the problem. His new book is called Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Connor, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
Good to be with you. So on March 7th, 2015, the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, you drove to Selma, Alabama to report on President Obama's speech at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. You ended up in this old Confederate cemetery, like looking for a place to park your car. Who did you meet there?
That's right. Yeah, I met a group that calls themselves the Friends of Forrest there. I pulled into the cemetery. Selma's one of those old southern cities that has the, you know, a big cemetery big enough to have its own system of roads. So I just duck in there thinking I can find a place to stash my car. But what I find are all of these signs staked into the ground that say, Confederate Memorial Circle, closed, no trespassing. And that's kind of catnip for a reporter. So I, of course, I want to find out more. So I get out of my car and I wander over and a few folks come to meet me. And I just sort of very credulously ask them, you know, what are you doing here? Like, you know, this is a Confederates on a civil rights anniversary. What? Anyway, I come to find that, you know, this group had spent really the better part of two decades fighting in Selma about this statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest that they'd put up. And as you indicate in your intro, you know, putting a statue of Forrest up anywhere would be controversial. To do it in Selma, the city that's sort of synonymous with Black voting rights, really compounded the injury. And then I came to learn the fact that they did it in October of 2000, the same week that the city's first Black mayor had been inaugurated, just made it all the more controversial, but also indicated, made it clear that this, even though this was a monument about someone from the past, it was also really about a battle in the present as well. So, this encounter and the strangeness, the dissonance of that encounter on that day, the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, just raised a bunch of questions for me about who Forrest was and what it meant to put up a monument to him today. And so I've been down that rabbit hole ever since.
All right. So Nathan Bedford Forrest is maybe not the best known Civil War general to most people. There was an allusion to him in the movie Forrest Gump. How is Forrest remembered by white people in Tennessee?
That's right. He is a little bit more an obscure general than someone maybe like Robert E. Lee, but I think he is really revealing about how Confederate memory works. Forrest is admired for being a sort of instinctive military leader, unlike someone like Lee, who went to West Point. Forrest had never been to West Point. Forrest had hardly went to school at all, and yet really distinguished himself during the war as this cunning, instinctual, sort of natural military leader, which he's admired for. But because he enlisted as a private, because he fought in minor battles in the Western theater of the war, he's not given the opportunity Lee gets. He's not at Gettysburg, for instance. He's seen as the sort of great white hope. What could have been if only Forrest had been given a more prominent role in the Civil War, then maybe the South would have won. So people who to this day want to sort of Monday morning quarterback the war, who are yelling that the South will rise again, Forrest is kind of their guy. He's a sort of everyman hero, and this overlooked general who would have delivered the South a victory in the war.
So there was Forrest in the war. There was also Forrest before the war, and I was really taken aback, honestly, by the ads that he posted buying and selling human beings. You would think that any kind of ad like this would be equally disgusting, but there is something about the copy in these ads from the mid-19th century. It sounds like something you'd use today at like a discount used car lot.
I think that's right. Just disturbing to think about, but also revealing that this really was the mindset of Forrest and people like Forrest, that in order to justify the depravity, the violence, the torture that was the American slave trade and the American slave system, white Americans had to tell themselves a lie about what they saw as the inherent inferiority of the people that they were enslaving. And that was the way that they justified it. That's the way I think that they sort of coped with the just absolute violence and horror of what they were doing.
So people who aren't history buffs have heard about Gettysburg and Antietam and Bull Run and Atlanta. What happened at Fort Pillow?
So Fort Pillow is a fort on the banks of, built on a bluff above the Mississippi River. It's a little bit north of Memphis, so it's in West Tennessee. And toward the end of the war in 1864, there were a couple of regiments of U.S. colored troops there. So after the Emancipation Proclamation, not only does that give an order to, that the formerly enslaved would be emancipated, but it also allows them to enlist in the Union Army. And so there are a couple of troops there at this fort when Forrest and his cavalry arrive. And this is the first time that Forrest troops had encountered the USCT, the US colored troops in battle. The battle only lasts about an hour. Forrest's men pretty quickly overtake the fort. And as these soldiers are surrendering, they're shot down. Nearly 200 Black soldiers are killed, many of them while surrendering. Some of the reports from this battle are really discomforting to read. Forrest talks about the river run red with blood, and that how he hopes that this proves that black people cannot cope with Southerners, as he put it. Although he used a different word. It was a massacre, and it was pretty clearly racially motivated. There was an investigation after the war, and it was clear that they could have brought him up on charges as a war criminal, but ultimately decided not to.
So a lot of once wealthy Southerners found themselves floundering after the war, now that their enslaved labor force had been liberated. Nathan Bedford Forrest pivoted, once again made money off some of the same bodies he had always bought and sold.
That's right. Yeah, he tried his hand at some business ventures, working in the railroads, all of which eventually went belly up. And by the end of his life, he was working in President's Island, which is just off of Memphis and the Mississippi River, operating a convict leasing system. This is a an institution that the historian Douglas Blackman has called slavery by another name. Basically, you know, after Reconstruction has sort of been undermined by people like Forrest and the Klan, as the former Confederates returned to power, they found ways of criminalizing Blackness. People, Black Americans could be, you know, brought up on charges for any reason or any, you know, illusion of a reason, and then could be inscribed into this convict leasing system that, like you say, was a way of, you know, replenishing the labor force in a region that had you know, become incredibly wealthy on you know, enforced labor.
All right. And just to make sure that we get this all out there, there was his history with the KKK. How did it happen that Nathan Bedford Forrest became the first Grand Wizard in the history of the Klan?
Yeah. So in the years of Reconstruction, so after the war, you know, sort of 1865 to 1877, there is this moment where the central question of the war is front and central. Can a formerly slave society actually transform itself into a multiracial democracy? So we get the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, equal protection under the law, voting rights for the formerly enslaved. And there is some, you know, progress made toward realizing that that multiracial democracy. But of course, that is fought and undermined tooth and nail by groups like the Klan, who worked through guerrilla warfare to disenfranchise voters, to intimidate, to, you know, rape, pillage, kill Black Americans, and then, you know, any white Americans who were voicing support for that, you know, new way of organizing the country. And they worked in dens, you know, these sort of vigilante groups spread out across the South, but they needed a leader, a sort of figurehead that could unite them and sort of give them a common cause to work for. And so, you know, a former Confederate general fit the bill perfectly. And so, you know, Forrest, who had become a real legend through his exploits as a Confederate cavalry leader in the war, was ripe for that kind of figurehead position at the top of the Klan.
You remind us in the book of something that is easy to overlook, which is that it didn't have to be this way. Tell us about Benjamin Turner and the brief moment of promise that he represents.
Yeah, so Benjamin Turner was born in North Carolina, but really came of age in Selma, Alabama, which is where a lot of my reporting for this book started. It's, of course, where the sort of first encounter that sent me on this journey took place. But Benjamin Turner was enslaved in Selma before the war. After the war, though, really pursued the, you know, this other way of being, a new way of building the country along lines other than those meant to, you know, perpetuate white supremacy. So he helped start a freedman school to, you know, provide education for people in Selma. He's elected to the U.S. Congress. There's a wonderful lithograph by Currier and Ives of this incoming class of Black congressmen from 1872. And it's images like that are a really stark reminder that for this brief moment during Reconstruction, we were realizing this other way of being, where we really could, you know, find this a way of forging a multiracial democracy, providing equal protection under the law, voting rights, political power, with people who formerly were being physically, spiritually tortured, whose labor was being stolen to, you know, make the, you know, this mammoth modern industrial economy, you know, North and South. So he does really represent this flicker of a reconstructed country, but of course he like the rest of that class of Black congressmen are soon voted out as Reconstruction is undermined, as former Confederates return to power in the Southern states and start disenfranchising Black voters again.
My guest is journalist Connor Towne O'Neill. He's a producer of NPR's White Lies podcast and teaches at Auburn University. His new book is Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Connor Towne O'Neill. He produces the NPR White Lies podcast. He teaches at Auburn University and with the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. His new book is called Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. So, Connor, this book is about the sort of cult of Nathan Bedford Forrest that still exists across much of the American South, and we'll talk more about that. But it is broader than that. You use this story to interrogate how easy it is for white people today to fail to acknowledge the ways our society is still enabling white supremacy. You're from Pennsylvania, and you had sort of assumed you were not tied in any direct way to the evils of slavery. How did you start to rethink that as you began to meet people who really loved Nathan Bedford Forrest?
Yeah, so that was certainly the most revealing and discomforting part of the reporting of this book. But as I looked at the ways that Forrest is remembered and defended in the years after the Civil War, I came to see what I came around to calling a sort of cold Civil War. Mm. These different ways that, you know, the battlefield weren't battlefields anymore, but they were classrooms, courtrooms, you know, banks, real estate offices, all of the different ways that this unequal society tilted to benefit white Americans has been fought in the years after the Civil War. The ways that white Americans have sort of resisted the consequence of the South losing the Civil War. That might have led to emancipation, but that military victory wasn't enough to vanquish this this lie of white supremacy that was being used to justify it and lived on long after the war had ended. So as I start to look at ways that these inequalities get perpetuated, whether that's who is included or left out of FHA loans or segregated schools or the GI Bill or the Social Security Act, I came to really see that these Confederate monuments might be an exponent of the system that we only encounter in the South, but they're symbols of a system that exists in the North just as much as they do in the South, and that it can be really convenient for folks in the North, you know, like me, to think, oh, that's just a problem down there. Or like, yeah, I guess they're still fighting the Civil War down there. But like, you know, we're affiliated with the Union Army. The Union Army did this great thing, the great emancipator. You know, we can sort of absent ourselves from any, you know, any ongoing issues regarding the Civil War. Robert Penn Warren, the great writer, called that the treasury of virtue, this sense that we can, we're sort of, you know, inoculated from our history, or that it doesn't continue to shape our lives. But the more that I dug into the lingering consequences of the Civil War, Americans' unwillingness to grapple with the meaning of emancipation, the more I came to see that race had shaped my life too, that it, of course, it impacted how my parents bought their house, for example. And then, you know, the kind of neighborhood they were able to get a house in, which then meant, you know, the kind of school that I went to, the way that school was funded, how I was seen by teachers or police officers as I was going to school, you know, all these ways, all the lines that my life has moved along, of course, have been shaped by race. It's just that we don't like to point it out or talk about it, especially in the North. So as I was reporting on something in the South, I was really coming to see the more kind of insidious and subtle ways that race continues to shape the lives of all Americans. It's just sort of harder to see in the North, and I had to move south to see it, but I eventually did.
I think another thing that a lot of people are waking up to is the fact that long after the Northern states abolished slavery, slave labor in the South fed Northern industry and commerce.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Edward Baptist has a great book on this, The Half Has Never Been Told, that really documents the ways that the slave system was used to build the modern economy, and how all these instruments of capitalism are developed to extract more and more wealth from enslaved people, you know, speculators, mortgages, you know, all of these different things that we associate with the stock market now are being developed as responses to slavery. And of course, you know, the burgeoning factories in Boston or even across the pond in Liverpool or Manchester in England. I mean, it's this massive driver of economic economic gains that implicate people way above the Mason-Dixon line.
What role did Confederate symbols and sort of Confederate soldier hagiography play for defeated white Southerners in the immediate aftermath of the war?
Yeah, I mean, I think creating this sort of the cult of the Southern soldier was a way of sidestepping thornier questions about how to grapple with the meaning of the war. There were basically two main tasks of Reconstruction. One, like we talked about earlier, was the full investment of citizenship with the formerly enslaved. And then the other was the reunification of the North and South, which is to say a sort of a way for white Americans on you know, Union and Confederate to broker a sort of peace between the two. They were sort of more mutually exclusive, and the reunification of North and South won out over the full enfranchisement of Black Americans. So if you're not going to grapple with the consequences of building this country on slavery, and instead it's easier to look to the heroism of the soldier, the sacrifice, the tragedy of their death. And so that's why you see, you know, in so many courthouse squares across the South, you see these statues to the Confederate dead. That's a way of getting people to think about the war and the meaning of the war only in terms of the individual the tragedy of a soldier's death, rather than the much bigger issues that are raised by, you know, having a slave society and trying to do away with that or not fully do away with that. With that slave society, so it's like a massive coping mechanism for avoiding the more difficult questions. We can honor the bravery of the Southern soldier, but you can't mention slavery, because if you mention slavery, then you might call their heroism into question.
So the first Nathan Bedford Forrest statue you became aware of was in Selma, Alabama. White flight from Selma is still happening. You remind us that Selma today is one of the poorest cities and one of the poorest counties and one of the poorest states in the country. Ironically, some people in the community feel as if Selma's really difficult racial history scares away new development before it can ever begin. It's like a vicious cycle.
That's right. Yeah. As one source in Selma put it to me, like, politicians want to come to kiss the Blarney Stone, which is to say they want to come for these anniversaries of Bloody Sunday and cross over the bridge, but don't want to invest in the town, build a factory there. I think a vicious cycle is a really good word for it. It's sort of, it can't escape its history.
We have T on the line in Baton Rouge. Hi, T.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I just kind of wanted to just kind of chime in and ask the journalist, has he ever heard of a theory called cognitive dissonance?
Could you say a little bit more about that, T? What about cognitive dissonance comes to mind in this conversation?
Just kind of showing how, you know, being able to take the context of the Bible and flip the words to conveniently do things that they were doing for their everyday living, so they didn't feel wrongdoing in what they were doing. Like just little lines out the Bible that says things simply as obey your masters, but that's not really meaning exactly what they mean, and using that to say, you know, it's not wrong about what we're doing to Black people because it's in the Bible. So that was their way of dealing with, you know, what they were doing.
Okay, yeah, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that there are, you know, there's the I mean the central sort of cognitive dissonance, and I'm grateful for T for putting that for introducing that phrase. Yeah, I think the central and important cognitive dissonance of America is to claim that we're a country rooted in liberty, freedom, while, you know, pursuing the project of that country on settled land that was the product of, you know, massive dislocation and genocide of native peoples, to be, you know, sitting in constitutional convention with the men that the founding fathers were enslaving or preparing their meals at night while they write it. You know, that cognitive dissonance is at the heart of the country, and those that tension between having these ideals of freedom and opportunity and yet having the structures of the country run along these systems that produce massive amounts of inequity and violence and break down along racial lines is a massive amount of cognitive dissonance, and one that continues to flare up, because, you know, we have a summer like the one we had this summer because we haven't, which feels like the summer that we had in 1968, which feels like, you know, the summers that we had in 1861, or 1868 for that matter, because we have this central unresolved tension at the heart of this country, that, yeah, I think to T's point, causes massive amounts of cognitive dissonance.
All right, let's move on to Murfreesboro, which is home of Middle Tennessee State University. The tribute to Nathan Bedford Forrest there was a building and also a mascot. How did students organize to protest this building named Forrest Hall?
Yeah, so in 2015, the fall semester of 2015, in the aftermath of the Charleston 9 murders that summer, and inspired by Bree Newsom scaling the flagpole at the South Carolina Capitol to remove the Confederate flag that flew there, students on campus organized at MTSU to try and get the school to change the name of Forrest Hall, and in response, the university said, okay, we're going to create a task force to debate this idea about whether we should change the name or not. And so they held these forums throughout the school year, trying to, you know, hear from both sides, people on campus, people in the community, should we keep the name, should we change the name, or should we keep the name, but with added context. And I think that the way that task force was structured really frustrated the student activists. You know, as one of them said to me, we don't feel like racism should be debated at this point. Hmm. And really saw that sort of long drawn out process as a bad faith way of approaching the problem. And so they continued to demonstrate, they continued to protest, they testified at these forums in compelling ways, talking about the indignity, the dehumanizing fact of having a building on campus named after someone who didn't see them as human. But they did more than that. They did more than just testify. And because they saw it in as a sort of bad faith debate, they also undermined it. They staged walkouts from these forums. They marched to the president's house. They one of the organizers published a letter in the local newspaper calling on all students of color to transfer, or calling on all Black students to transfer to HBCUs. Because they were sort of done asking to be included, done asking to be, you know, vested with equal standing in the university, and so they were done with it, and they should leave. It was a complicated and really interesting campaign to report on, because I think it pointed up one, just the deeply polarized nature of political debate in 2015 and 2016, but two, I think underscored what was at stake for activists protesting this stuff.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The students who wanted this name change had to go up against something called the Tennessee Heritage Protection Act. What kinds of impediments did the act create for doing something like renaming a hall named for a KKK Grand Wizard and Confederate General when like a third of the school's population is Black?
Yeah, I mean, it really created a sort of bureaucratic nightmare for the protesters. The first iteration of that that law required a majority of the state historical commission to approve the request to change the name of anything having to do with historical importance in the state. And then after the Charleston 9 murders and a renewed renewed set of protests against the kinds of Confederate symbols in the state of Tennessee, that law then was strengthened to require a supermajority of the historical commission to approve any change. So the protesters, even though they had grown sort of cynical over the year of protesting, thinking that their complaints were falling on deaf ears, the task force actually did recommend that they change the name of the building. The university president then agreed with them and said, okay, I think we should change the name too. But then he had to kick it up to the the state board of regents that oversees Middle Tennessee State. But the board of regents also agreed, okay, we should change the name. But then of course the last hurdle was the state historical commission, and they said no. So Forest Hall is still Forest Hall.
Wow. You know, I can get my head around why some white people have a hard time fully grasping what white supremacy feels like for people of color. What's harder for me to understand is why folks won't just take the word of their black neighbors. Like, this is painful. This is frightening. Why do you think the knee-jerk response from some people is trying to just shut down any conversation about the effects of racism?
I think people hold tightly to the stories that they tell themselves. And so any challenges to our history or to how we should feel about our history can feel very personal. And so I think people are resistant to a change in how we look at our history, because it might induce, or it might prompt us to think, change how we think about ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think the stories that a lot of white Americans tell themselves are deeply intoxicating and seductive about this American exceptionalism and what a great, unimpeachably great country we come from. And so any referendum on our past is really can destabilize who we think we are in the present, and that can be scary. I'm not saying that's not to defend it, but I think that's what's going on there.
My guest is journalist Connor Towne O'Neill. He produces NPR's White Lies podcast. He teaches at Auburn University and the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project, and has a new book out called Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. We'll be right back. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Connor Towne O'Neill. He's a producer of NPR's podcast White Lies, teaches at Auburn University and the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project, and has written a new book called Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And that is where we find Sharon on the line in Glen Rose, Texas. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Well, my great-great-grandfather was a cavalry colonel under General Bedford, and my family for years clung to that, you know, historic, wonderful Southern history, and the challenges that young people bring up to older people holding on to these cherished ideas, I think, are going to really make a difference in the future. And they certainly did for me. And I think they're our best hope.
Sharon, thank you so much for calling. Can I, if I can keep you on the line for a second. So are you saying like your kids or grandkids or some other relatives said, hey, this is not, we can't think about this history in these glowing terms?
Yes, my daughter specifically, when I would relate back to genealogy, and I have to say I did feel conflicted about my family's positions, and was certainly open to, you know, saying that they had positions that were hurtful to African-Americans, you are always still trying to balance what your legacy is and what it, and she didn't seem to have near the angst about that I did, and she just says, well, this is just terrible.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your story, Sharon. Thank you so much for calling. Do you want to respond to that, Connor?
Yeah, I thanks so much, Sharon. I think that that kind of transformation is really difficult, but like you say, you know, really, really urgently necessary right now. So I appreciate you sharing that story. I think it is. I think a lot of us do have this sense that our history does need to flatter us. Hmm. But I think more and more, I think partly because younger people are really experiencing all of the issues as they come home to roost right now, whether that be in terms of climate change or you know, racial inequities. I think we're more people are feeling them and are able to put them in a historical context to sort of see the roots of these issues that we're grappling with in the present. And that's prompting them to lead this referendum on our history, and not just a referendum on our history, but how we look back to our history, rather than to look back in a way that we want to, you know, flatter us or reassure us. Instead, I think more people are looking back at our past in order to find ways for accounting for the you know, really drastic issues that we're facing right now. And so that leads to a different way of thinking about someone like Forrest. I think this moment of referendum is challenging, but I think it's massively important. And in sharing stories like that about those kinds of transformations are really important. So I'm grateful for that call.
Okay, I can't let this conversation conclude without talking about the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue built in Nashville by Jack Kershaw, who is best known not as an artist, but as a defense attorney for James Earl Ray, who, of course, is the gunman who killed Martin Luther King. Kershaw's contribution to this genre of monument is so bizarre that I urge people to Google it. Will you describe this sculpture?
I think in some ways it defies description. You know, I spent 5 years trying to find the best line to capture the grotesque but also cartoonish nature of this monument. I think it's one of those great things that just defy description. I'd encourage you to Google it. It's gold and silver and wild-eyed and almost sort of lizard-like. I think of it as a sort of like it's the Dorian Gray, the portrait of Dorian Gray of Confederate monuments. Like that one is withering and ugly, even while the other ones stay more composed and dour.
I was thinking about this, and I do not defend the monument or the spirit in which it was put up, but in some ways it is so grotesque and so exaggerated and weird that in some ways it's almost an ideal monument to lingering white supremacy. And I'm not saying that we should honor white supremacy, but it really sort of shows it for all of the illusions that are caught up within white supremacy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's sort of too ugly to bear the kinds of honor that we expect monuments to convey. But instead, yeah, it does. What it symbolizes is this ugly, recalcitrant, nightmarish vision of this country and what it should look like. So yeah, I think that's a good point.
How does today's white supremacy, as expressed by groups like Unite the Right in Charlottesville, compare with what existed before the civil rights movement?
I think that what we're seeing now is the kind of entitlement that comes from white Americans have to ask for what for so long was just kind of given to them by virtue of the policies of this country. Now, to be sure, there are so many policies that we have in this country that lead to unequal outcomes, whether that's in housing and schools and access to healthcare. But I think, you know, before the civil rights movement, the board was explicitly stacked or tilted towards towards white Americans. You know, even just in the way that public space was organized was meant to elevate white Americans. That was, white supremacists were defending what was a status quo. After the legislative victories of the movement, in the second half, moving forward into the second half of the 20th century, now white supremacists were sort of antagonizing the state or antagonizing the status quo. And Kathleen Bellow has a great book that that outlines that shift, called Bringing the War Home. But yeah, there's a sort of change in more sort of antagonized anti-government attitude, partly because the government is now in modest ways, at least, seeking to address these lasting inequities that break down along racial lines. Once some white people stop being able to collect on what W.E.B. Du Bois called the wages of whiteness, they now feel disenfranchised. They feel victimized. They feel like there's a sort of white genocide taking place. And so they need to be in the streets defending their monuments because they feel like they're defending their what used to be at least their privileged status in this country.
Based on what you've written here, it's pretty clear that you hold anti-racist views. I'm curious, when you interview white supremacists, I'm guessing sometimes they might assume that you're with them by virtue of the color of your skin. Like, how do you behave in those situations? Like, you know, when you're trying to get an interview with someone and trying to make them trust you and tell you what they really think, you don't want to jump all over them right away. At the same time, people are saying these abhorrent things to you. I wonder if you can talk about what that's like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was important for me to grapple with their point of view, and if I was going to be writing about them, I wanted to to get their points of view, not to sort of falsely elevate their position or do a sort of got to hear both sides, to suggest a sort of false equivalency there. But I did want their points of view to be in the book, but to also build a context around their points of view to show the consequences of holding beliefs like that and the harm that is done to others and really to themselves for holding views like that. I would explain that, like, I'm writing this book, I'm following these campaigns, you know, I want to hear your side of this. I want to hear why you're defending this. Of course, you know, it's not like I would let things linger, assertions that would make, I would push back against. And with something like the Confederacy, it's pretty straightforward. It's like, well, here's what Jefferson Davis says in this speech, or here's what the documents of secession say. Like, they were telling anyone who would listen in the lead up to the war why they were fighting this war, and how they were defending those positions. I wouldn't let assertions stand unchecked, but I also did want them to, I wanted to include their voices in the book as well. It was tricky. And a lot of people just didn't talk to me. I think knowing that, you know, this was, as one person who rejected my interview said, like, they didn't want someone else to tell, quote, our story. Some people were pretty defensive and standoffish about it, but I think other people, like you said, I think were sort of looking to recruit me, and felt like I should come to see it from their point of view, because in some sense, like, the things that they were advocating for would materially benefit my life. Continuing to build a country that is explicitly for the benefit of white Americans meant that, you know, it's felt like a no-brainer to them that I would come to see it from their point of view. And it's actually the ways that that those sorts of folks would interact with me that prompted me to be even more self-reflexive and interrogate, you know, how I was positioned to this debate. I couldn't sort of just absent myself from it or think that I didn't have a stake in it, because it was clear to the people that I were talking to that I did have a stake in it, and they wanted me to see that too. So that's, you know, I tried to really wrestle with that aspect of it too in the book, because it was, you know, a central part of the reporting of the book.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So what does it mean as a white person, and I'm asking this for myself as well, in a country where white supremacy continues to benefit white people, even if we don't wish to hold racist views, if we want to be anti-racist, what does it mean to grapple with white supremacy when we're still beneficiaries, even if we think it's terrible? And what, how do we shake that off?
Well, I think that it underscores how, you know, you can have, that it's important to look at policies and outcomes and not just at what's in someone's hearts. Hmm. So, it can be easy to think about racism in terms of like, oh, what does this one individual think or feel in their hearts and think about racism on that individual level. When instead, if we really do want to forge that multiracial democracy and eliminate white supremacy, it's better to focus on outcomes of policies, who's harmed and who benefits, who is able to hoard wealth, resources, opportunities, and who are they being hoarded from. And in that way, you know, we can still see race as operating as a way of perpetuating inequity, but we're not locating it on individuals, but instead looking at systems and who they benefit. And that's where we can focus our reconstruction, really. I think, you know, that's where we're at this moment again, like we were in the aftermath of the Civil War, like we were in the Civil Rights Movement 100 years later, you know, at this really calamitous moment where so much seems to hang in the balance, that I think if we can focus on, looking at where wealth is and who has it, where opportunities are, where access to resources or healthcare, especially in a time of pandemic, when disproportionate numbers of Black Americans are dying from it, we got to look at that. We got to zoom out and look at those systems.
Any thoughts on what should happen to Confederate monuments that are being taken down in various parts of the country?
I'm always willing to defer to the people who live in the places where those statues stand. Mm. I will say though that there is a real power in some of the scenes we saw this summer of people, you know, in Birmingham tying a chain to a Confederate monument and the other end to the back of a truck and trying to haul it down that way, or at a small town in Virginia coming at the courthouse square with sledgehammers and paint and fire. I think there's a real power to people in those places sort of rising up and going at them with whatever they have at hand. But generally, I think it's important to defer to the people who live in the places where those stands, because they are these daily reminders of, insults and, meant to be this really sort of pernicious way of reminding a sense of who's considered human and who isn't.
Journalist Connor Town O'Neill is a producer of the NPR podcast White Lies and teaches at Auburn University and the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. His book is Down Along with That Devil's Bones, a reckoning with monuments, memory, and the legacy of white supremacy. Connor, thanks for spending this time with us.
It was great. I really enjoyed it, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just type KERA Think into the search bar or catch up on what you've missed at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.